Welcome to Lit from the Basement. This is Danielle.
This is Max.
I'm an author and professor.
I was a rocket man burning out my fuse up there all alone. Rocket man. Now I'm a stay-at-home dad.
We're a married couple who discuss literature in our basement while our children are sleeping. Our show is pretty simple. I introduce Max, my poetry-resistant husband.
I'm that husband.
To a poem, which we use as a springboard for conversation in the 1 hour we have to ourselves in the evening.
The boys are now asleep.
So let's talk.
Very good.
So today was gorgeous.
Yes.
Completely beautiful outside. And it got me thinking about beautiful days past with good friends.
Okay.
Barbecues.
Mm-hmm.
Having too many drinks.
Or just having warm feet. Warm, dry feet.
Warm, dry feet.
All I want now in my 50s. Late 40s.
I was like, you're 50s.
I know. If I just resigned to it now.
Did you turn 50 sometime?
In my mind, yes. So that way, when it actually happens, it'll be okay.
You're preparing like way too many years in advance.
Going to settle into it now.
Yeah, apparently. Well, we get you a Barco lounger. Maybe.
Oh,
some.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can put your feet up.
Yeah.
Get you a.
Jesus, the kids can just get me iced teas or some. Really old cans of Coors beer, the kind with the pull tops. Yeah.
Get you a hat.
Yeah, a hat with an aircraft carrier number on it. Yeah.
Despite your complete non-involvement with
the
Air Force or military.
But
of
I'm
any
just
kind.
Done. I quit.
Yeah. Okay, good to know. I'm glad to know what I have in my future.
Yeah, I want the baby boomer lifestyle now.
Interesting you would say that. We are talking about a baby boomer today.
Oh, I tied it in for you.
Unwittingly, but yes.
Okay.
Excellent transition, you. So today we are talking about Gary Soto's Ambition.
Mm-hmm.
Not his ambition as in his personal, but his poem, Ambition.
Gotcha.
Which does encapsulate an evening with friends.
Oh, okay. That's where you were going and I did. Okay, go ahead. Oh, I derailed your topic and your train of thought.
When has that ever happened? And I think, you know, I was maybe thinking of him and I was trying to figure out which poem of his that I wanted to do. And I think the day made me decide. I met him actually last semester. He came to Willamette University to give a reading.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was delightful. We had dinner at Raffin's with my colleague Scott and my other colleague Mike. It was funny because he walked into the restaurant and I knew his face, you know, from pictures and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I liked him immediately.
Where he kicked the door open.
With the six guns blazing.
hung his rifle up over the antlers that were rolled the rap. Yeah.
No.
Okay.
He came. He was warm and he was friendly, you know, but there was something about his manner and the way that he spoke that was very familiar to me.
Okay.
That reminded me actually of my family.
Well, oh, I'm guessing the good members of your family.
Yeah, the Mexican side. I mean, maybe it's just like a, you know, he's from California. He's from the baby boomer generation.
I saw the name Soto. I'm like, God, I know lots of Sotos in L.A.
He's Mexican-American. Mm-hmm. But I swear he like walked in and I thought immediately like that he could be one of my uncles.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in personality, but also slightly in looks. He kind of looks like my Uncle Joe.
Okay.
But also just like the way he talks, like the cadences of his speech and the way he jokes around. And he's a big joker and he's a big storyteller, which came to light pretty easily in his in the reading that he gave, which he was great. But here's the thing. He was about to give a reading, like the whole house was full of people.
Uh-huh.
And somebody somewhere pulled the fire alarm in the library. So everybody was escorted out but walked out of the building.
Mm-hmm. In an orderly fashion?
In an orderly fashion, and mostly a like confused fashion. Everybody's like, "What?
Why?
Yes, why? Like, clearly this was just a prank."
Did he give a reading out in the square?
No, he did not.
Okay,
no, well,
probably raining.
No, it wasn't actually. Oh. It was luckily a clear night. At least it wasn't raining. It was kind of a.
It must have been before October and after June. Then that this reading happened.
I think it was in October. I can't quite remember. Okay. But here's the thing.
Okay. Yes.
So he's out on the square and everybody's there. So before everybody was like orderly sitting down, you know, that sort of thing. But since he was just standing there among everybody else, it was so sweet. All of these people started coming up to him, and it was clear that there were a lot of people in the audience who were from the community and not just the college students who come to campus, which is not true of many of our readings. And they had come to hear him because they had grown up reading his books, because he's also a child author.
Oh.
Because he's also an author of children's books, rather, not a child author. Maybe he was a child author. I
signed my first deal with crayons.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, get that boy a...
that boy's got it.
Get that boy a book contract.
Somebody give that five-year-old a juice box and a lawyer to sign this contract.
No, but he's written a lot of children's books, and I think a lot of people actually grew up reading him, and so we're just really excited to hear him read. And it was the sweetest thing because they all came up to him to talk to, you know, like usually with their parents, just some middle schoolers, some high schoolers, you know, and they're like, I just love your books. I've been reading your books. And he's like, oh, thank you so much. And he's like, you want a picture with me? And they were like, yes, you know, so like people. So, of course, one person wanted a picture of him and then other people. And so I never do this.
Oh, you did?
Yes, you I did.
And you haven't shown me this picture. You're hiding it then.
No, I posted it on my social media. You just apparently like don't read my social media pages.
Really? Really? I love you. I kneel and kiss your little feet. But I have to add that to my list also.
No, you really don't. I'm just saying there is a picture of me with Gary Soto.
Okay.
But I never do this with visiting
writers.
So everybody
showed up for... Yeah, that grew up with him, and so did he do kind of a Gary Soto after hours, after dark? Like, not the kids' books tonight.
No, I mean...
It's kind of... Okay.
It was a reading for an adult audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there were no readings of his children's books while he spoke. But no, he was great. He read from a number of pieces, but he also just talked about, you know, his life growing up, how he just wasn't... He wasn't into school that for a while, and how he kind of stumbled into writing and then just like fell deeply in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it had a certain resonance for a lot of the people in the audience. It's many of my students anyway came to class really, really charmed by him. But he's also really funny, like making cracking all kinds of jokes, very comfortable in front of an audience. So that was really, really lovely. So I wanted to do a poem by him. And let me tell you just a little bit about his sort of official bio.
Okay.
Okay. So Gary Soto has published more than 40 books for children, young adults, and adults, including Baseball in April, Living Up the Street, A Summer Life, Buried Onions, and The Afterlife. He's also the author of Oranges, the most anthologized poem in contemporary literature. He's been awarded fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Twice.
Okay.
And his new and selected poems, which we've taken the poem from for today's podcast, was a 1995 finalist for both the National Book Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Award.
Hmm.
In 1999, he was featured as NBC Person of the Week for his advocacy for reading.
Okay.
He now lives in Berkeley, California.
Hmm.
A little bit about his style, and I took this from the poets.org site, but I thought it was a good quote. I agreed with it, which is why I thought it was good. Of his work, the writer Joyce Carol Oates has said, Gary Soto's poems are fast, funny, heartening, and achingly believable, like Polaroid love letters or snatches of music heard out of a passing car, patches of beauty like patches of sunlight. The very pulse of a life. And I'm not surprised to hear this kind of praise about his work from another novelist.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that you can tell from reading any one of his works that he's a storyteller, as I mentioned before. And there's a deep narrative, almost fictional aspect to the poem that we're reading today. So should I don't think that there's any sort of preamble I need for you to get the poem. So
before I cut you off, you were talking about it, that you're selecting this one because of the wonderful single day of weather we had today.
Yeah. And thinking a lot lately about the value of friendship, and that is coming through in this poem very clearly.
If you want to read along with the poem, just go to our website, litfromthebasement.com. Click on the show notes tab along the top, then scroll to the show title with the poem's name. The most recent show is always on top.
Ambition by Gary Soto. For years, our ambition was to eat chicken, to sit in the backyard in an aftershock of heat when the sun was out of the way, this happened. Drunk under a tree, we became sophisticates of the lawn chair and beer bottles, trumpets we raised all night under those bitter stars that turned us to our lies of women, lost and found door to door. I was lonely once, I told them, and they booed and flicked beer tops at me, told me to get into the kitchen for the hard stuff. When I returned, Chris, the failed scholar of 3 degrees, talked Italy. Flames broke from the hibachi. The chicken grew noisy as a Latin mob. Quiet, John yelled, and poked them with a fork onto the platter. We went inside to argue over salad, a gaudy hat we stuffed into our mouths, and let food climb our elbows. Dogs snapped at bones, whined, jumped when we threw them buttered rolls, corn, rings of potato. We ate like Romans with good jobs, and returned to the backyard to find that the moon had moved our chairs. Lost them, in fact. We dropped on the grass, on elbows. The moon was clearing the trees by 2 fingers. I took bets we'd be happy. No one ever knows, the scholar sighed, empty trumpet in hand. I smiled. John smiled. Cats with full lives grinned from the back fence, sniffed, dropped to the ground to nudge us for the love of chicken, but love all the same.
So he's taking some of that humor he's sharing with his boys and giving it to us.
Yeah, definitely.
What you people will not hear is the fact that Danielle could not get through that reading the first time because she started laughing.
It's the I was lonely once. That part just cracks me up every time I get to it. It's a good laugh for me. Okay. So it probably sounds really redundant to say that the title is ambitious. Mm-hmm. but I think that about any title that uses a one word abstract, you know, if you're like
truth,
exactly right, or love, or you know, life, like whatever that is.
And as you have for
ambition is far less cliche, and I mean, right. I've never seen another poem mm-hmm. with this title, but still, it's kind of ballsy, yeah. Right? But you know, it immediately undercuts
that, yeah,
which is so great. So ambition, okay, what do we usually think of when we think of this word?
Well, anybody who is going to climb over somebody else or do anything that's necessary to get their American Dream meal ticket, I don't know.
Yeah, is there a particular, like, kind of person that you have, like a character?
I'm a little down on ambition right now. Because
your own or others?
All the wrong people have too much of it.
Oh, and, interesting.
And what they are not hitched to is also shame.
So, yeah, there's...
Less ambition, more shame.
Yeah, ambition does hold in it a kind of shamelessness mm-hmm. to it, right? Like the connotations of that word does. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to, but it's very different than, say, the word aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of like more of a pure desire mm-hmm. for
yeah,
some
and
kind
I,
of.
I'm aspiring to that.
Yes.
There's something above I will reach towards or at least move in a direction of.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Ambition by author Gary Soto. If you'd like to read the poem, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Right.
Ambition is, well, it's wonderful for the arts, but I just keep thinking about
well,
corporations and big pharma. And
right. Yeah. That's what you usually think of when you think of that.
Yes.
Right. Like what is your ambition mm-hmm. for? Right. And so it's hilarious to start.
For years, our ambition was to eat. So So like, this is starting off. Like he was like, he came up rough. He was, his family went hungry and oh, chicken. The next line.
but what you're picking up on there is actually like Soto writes a lot about being poor, like growing up poor.
Okay.
And so, and I don't think that that is a huge part of this particular poem, but the class here is clear.
Right. They're cooking on a hibachi.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a couple of guys who are sitting around on an evening. Like this is their like guy's night out.
Yeah.
And they're in, right? They're at somebody's house. They're doing the cooking, right? Like they're not sitting in some fine restaurant, you know, smoking cigars and swilling, you know, like whatever. But it's they're doing the cooking. They're drinking beers and they're hanging out in somebody's yard. They're sitting on lawn chairs, you know, but there actually is a slight, you know, for years, our ambition was to eat. And you're like, oh, and then you're like, chicken.
Like, oh, okay, I know the mood for the rest of this. Here we go.
But there's something about the word chicken that is in of itself funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It wasn't meat. It wasn't our fill. It was chicken.
And then to sit in the backyard in an aftershock of heat when the sun was out of the way. And so ambition, you have to think of it, is the highest you can aim for. Right? It's the thing that you like, you're like, I would kill for that. Like whatever it is. So it's the highest thing that you can hope for is usually what we think of it. Right. And here it's to sit in the backyard and eat chicken and, you know, ultimately to create a sense of community. But when the sun was out of the way is kind of cracking me up also because it's as if the sun were standing in the way of their ambition.
Yeah, the day. I want this day to be done. You get down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where's your beautiful sister, the moon? Get her up here. You go away.
You go away. You mean work, son. I want to grill on the hibachi and get drunk with my pals, right? And then, so the sun went down.
Mm-hmm.
This happened. which is straightforward. And again, he's introducing us to the voice. This really funny, straightforward. And then it goes, this happened. Drunk under a tree, we became sophisticates of the lawn chair and beer bottles, and then a dash, trumpets we raised, right? So I love that the beer bottles become trumpets in this line, imagistically in the dark while you're drinking.
The silhouette.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what taking a sip of beer would look like. And this is kind of silent music, silent because you're taking in instead of blowing out, right? Also because you can also make music of beer bottles.
Yeah, they probably became an impromptu jug band.
Yes, absolutely.
Don't you touch my cream soda.
Oh, but I want to make a beer bottle blow sound.
Poetry.
Trumpet.
Where's our NEA grant?
We have ambition.
Now we just need the fortune and the talent and so many other things to align. Okay. Back to the poem.
But also the idea of trumpets, right? In of itself, being like heralds.
Heralding something, yeah.
Uh-huh. So they're heralds of the small kingdom, right? Like they're raising their trumpets to announce the setting of the sun.
Announce that they're ready to have another.
Yes, exactly. Perhaps some of their own loneliness. Because in the next few lines, right? All night under those bitter stars that turned us to our lives of women lost and found door to door. You're shaking your head.
Well, the bitter stars?
Yeah.
Because they're envious? Or what? Why are the stars bitter?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that was one of my... So they're cold and distant.
Okay.
Right? Like any goal.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Or any Scandinavian lover. She's so Norwegian.
I don't have any experience with that. But perhaps also that remind them that they should aspire to something.
Mm.
Right? They're cold and bitter. Where we get a glimpse into what they should aspire to, perhaps in the next line. Because so far we're not given any traditional ideas of ambition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get to a line later on that may touch on ideas of career, right? But so far, it's just to like eat and hang out. So the stars are being sort of blamed for their urge to lie in this next moment, right? because those bitter stars that turned us to our lies of women lost and found door to door. I was lonely once.
I see him saying it more a sagely proclamation, like standing up, slightly tilting, holds his empty bottle out, his arms out, stretches, and goes, I was lonely once.
Really? I see it as like they're talking about these women, blah 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 blah, and there's like a pause in the conversation. He was like, I was lonely once. You know, as if like just that once and never again in your life were you lonely, right? But so I love their reaction, right? Clearly they're friends.
Yeah.
Clearly they're friends. I told them and they booed and flicked beer tops at me. Boo to that.
Yeah, somebody like did that coil up where you bend your elbow and you snap
the
cap at them.
Yeah. Told me to get into the kitchen for the hard stuff. No, okay. So this moment places us directly into a scene.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer in the past continuous tense as we began. You know, for years, our ambition was to eat chicken,
mm-hmm.
but in simple past tense, which creates a sense of more immediacy because mm-hmm. it's talking about a singular specific past event. Right. But here you get to the first instance of the dynamic between the speaker and his friends. Why are they asking him to go to the kitchen in this particular way? You know, why exactly do they boo? Because, you know, he's making a joke, which I think he is.
Yeah.
Maybe he was being honest and vulnerable. That's actually another reading of this.
Okay.
Right? I was lonely once, like a way that somebody may have been leading into a particular, like they had inadvertently become maudlin.
And they're like, no,
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 no, we're not doing that.
That's for when you're at your job and the sun is
yeah,
up.
Yeah, exactly. But if they're like, if we're going to talk about this, we need to be more drunk, is another way that you might be able to read that. That's not necessarily the way I read it. It's just another possible reading of this line. Or simply that ended this course of conversation and they decided to break into the booze, mm-hmm. right? Like that's another way to read it. So he goes into the kitchen, supposedly. We don't see him do that. We see him only return, right? When I return, supposedly with some booze,
mm-hmm.
Chris, the failed scholar of 3 degrees,
wow,
talked Italy. Yeah. Yes. Ouch.
Ouch.
For sure. Ouch. Right? And flames broke from the hibachi.
Right. That's...
The line breaks in this are wonderful. But, you know, when I returned, they were on another topic.
Mm.
And here is Chris, who has 3 degrees and yet is failed in his scholarship. He's talking about Italy, which is a faraway place, right, from where they are mm-hmm. at this particular moment. So Chris seemed to want to be a famous scholar at one point, at least.
Yeah.
Right. And he's talking Italy, not to like a lecture hall of people or to somebody interviewing him, but to his two friends and also to perhaps the noisy grilled chicken,
mm-hmm.
which is being stabbed in the next line.
Okay.
Right. So
quiet you.
Yeah. So flames broke, not from some, say, cathedral.
Yeah. But he's also like, and he was talked of Italy, flames broke, not past romance, not amorous interactions. It's the flames from the hibachi.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. His passion. No, it's
the chicken.
It's
the noisy chicken on the hibachi. I swear, and this is, they say yard, but I cannot think hibachi without just myself being in some thick stuccoed apartment balcony.
Yeah.
That's always where the hibachi was. There's like a hanging bicycle. There's not much room, but you're all crammed in, but you want to give the hibachi some distance. Lawn chairs are going to melt next to that little thing.
Yeah, I don't imagine the yard being like some grand, lush yard.
No,
I imagine it, if there is grass, it's really dry. There's lots of rocks. You know, it's more like a lot. Some little span, right?
There's beer caps here and there.
Yeah. Back to the chicken.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Which is really important.
Yeah, the flames broke from the hibachi.
The chicken grew noisy as a Latin mob. Quiet, John yelled and poked them with a fork into the platter. Perfect. So John's ambition here seems to be to eat, you know, perhaps to have peace,
mm-hmm.
be quiet, get in my belly, right? He's talking to the chicken here, which I think is super hilarious. And he pokes them and throws them onto a platter
mm-hmm.
so that they can be eaten. And then we went inside to argue over salad, a gaudy hat we stuffed into our mouths and let food climb our elbows.
So I'm guessing, well, the gaudy hat, very, very pretty idea. It's just some large bouquet of greenery. It's like they're eating a sundae. Easter Sunday hat.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Or something where you know, a hat that you would wear to something much more formal, mm-hmm. right? Some gaudy hat.
But it sounds like they did not have much pleasure. They're like, okay, let's at least check this box. We have to eat our greens.
Oh, I think that you're projecting there. A gaudy hat we stuff into our mouths.
Quiet you. We went inside to argue over salad, a gaudy hat we stuffed into our mouths. And let the food climb our elbows.
Yeah.
That is a time elapse. Like, you could just see that done in like still frame.
Yeah.
The food just letting you know time is passing. The food is creeping up. They're getting more drunk, more messy.
Uh-huh.
The food, you could see them gesturing now, probably spattering each other with food as they speak.
Yes, they are definitely inelegant eaters, right? like they're not in a restaurant. They're not in a nice place. But like, I love the way that he animates the inanimate throughout mm-hmm. the poem. And this is a good example of that. Like, the chicken is noisy as a Latin mob. The food climbs their elbows. They're not in a fine restaurant. There doesn't seem to be anyone among them that wants them to be more domesticated, right? Like, they kind of like look like barbarians at this point. Like, the food climbing their elbows. They're a little feral. They're left on their own. They don't actually have any women.
Yeah.
You know.
They're all in their 60s, unmarried bachelors. Hold on. This is actually quite sad.
I'm not imagining them in their 60s, unmarried bachelors at all. They're young guys. That's what I'm imagining for sure. Which is why the next line, bringing in animals, makes a perfect segue, right? Dogs snapped at bones, whined, jumped when we threw them buttered rolls. Corn, rings of potato. We ate like Romans with good jobs.
Such a good line.
Why such do you like that line?
Well, it's already decadent enough.
Yeah.
We believe decadent. We say we ate like Romans. Yeah. We reclined on Diaz's and.
Uh-huh.
But then we ate
and
like
then
Romans
ate until we
with
got
good
sick.
Jobs.
I know.
It's like the good jobs part. Just, I would like a good job.
Well, I mean, I think that that's one of the underlying things in this poem, right? Like, the guys don't have good jobs. Mm-hmm. Chris is a failed scholar of 3 degrees. What is he doing?
Well, he's working at Circuit City, but
there's something about, you know,
all the places I've worked with my 2 degrees.
Yeah.
Bookstore, Macy's, shoe department. I mean, you want to get helped by a bitter person, go find somebody with a degree to put your shoe on.
Can you guys imagine Max putting on your shoes?
I had people complain when I was talking well about the shoes.
Really?
Yeah. Johnstone and Murphy shoes, incredibly well padded, good durable shoe.
Right.
And it was and I told the person who was trying them on, I'm like, walk around on that. It's going to feel like you're walking around on deboned kittens.
Oh, no.
Which I thought was a great way to say soft, supple, keep your feet warm, and they're cute.
No, that's very dark.
Yeah.
I can see why that person complained. I'd be like, why is that person creeping me out? He's talking about dead kittens when I'm trying to buy shoes.
I think it was that I kept massaging his foot and I wouldn't blink as I stared him right in the eye as I put the shoe on. It's going to feel like deboned kittens. They're just rubbing the underside
of
his foot.
You're totally creeping me out right now. Yeah, that probably did it.
Yeah.
The stare probably wasn't any good.
Okay, I'm sorry. Back to the poem. So throwing these things at the food, buttered rolls, corn, rings of potato.
Yeah. Why does that make you laugh? I love it partly because.
Look at you throwing that to a dog. Here's some corn.
Well, I mean, if
dogs have carnassial teeth, they're just like not what they're down for.
Not necessarily, but maybe.
Yeah.
I know lots of dogs who've eaten vegetables and who like those sorts of things. You know, we ate like Romans with good jobs.
Yeah.
You know, the underlying thing is that they don't have good jobs, right? Like, maybe don't have any jobs by the way that they're going, right? Like, maybe Chris has a little bit of money enough to buy some chicken and some beer.
Or the last of his student loan advancement.
Indeed.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Max and Danielle. The poem we're discussing today is Ambition by Gary Soto. If you'd like to read the poem, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com.
But there's something else happening here, which is that Soto works in food a lot. It comes up constantly in his poetry and his other books. He's also, you know, the author of Too Many Tamales.
Isn't awesome title. Isn't food just a standard in any non-WASP poetry?
Not necessarily. Well, I mean, probably from the particular era that he came up in. I think beyond that, of it being sort of like a marker of, you know, a non-white ethnicity, that he uses it in order to talk about the relationship between people.
Mm-hmm.
Like here you have them eating, and it's not just that they're eating together for sustenance, that they're also having this kind of communion of friendship,
mm-hmm.
right? But I also think about actually another poem of his called Oranges.
You mentioned that. It's the most anthologized.
Yeah, where it's about like a kid going on, I think probably a first date when he's like 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't have enough money to buy candy for the girl that he takes to the store, but does have two oranges in his pocket, and he sort of like hands the orange to the storekeeper as like half payment.
Uh-huh.
And the person's like, okay.
Because he's the kid, like, yeah. Needs this win.
Yes, totally. like, and, you know, of course, like, I imagine, like, Gary Soto himself, like, you know, huge-eyed, you know,
like,
a Chicano boy.
Pleading, like,
yeah, yes.
Like, His eyes just conveying that, please,
right.
Dude.
And the storekeep is like, yeah, okay. And his girl gets to eat the candy as they're walking out, and she has the candy, and he's got the orange in his hand. He says, from a distance, someone would have thought I was making a fire in my hands by the way the orange looked. Anyways, but there's, I mean, food's all over this.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's all over them.
It's totally all over them. Okay, so they ate like Romans with good jobs in the kitchen, supposedly, and then returned to the backyard to find that the moon had moved. But I love this line break, right? The moon had moved, and you're like, okay, well,
time has passed.
Time has passed, and then line break, our chairs, right? The moon had moved our chairs, lost them. In fact, we dropped on the grass on elbows, and I love this. Okay, either they're too drunk to remember where they put their lawn chairs,
yeah,
or the lawn chairs were stolen while they were in the house, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? You know, if you're in an urban area. And then instead of like bemoaning this fact or going on a search for the lawn chairs, like they're drunk and they're full. Right. And they're with each other.
Yeah.
And it's a good night. Right. We dropped on the grass on elbows. So the moon intervenes here. And again, with the moon, you can't help but think about romance,
mm-hmm.
just generally about dreams.
Werewolves.
This poem is about werewolves. No, it is not. What are they called?
Lycanthropes.
Okay.
Also, that's a menstrual cycle relation, not romance.
Oh, really?
The werewolf comes out every 28 days. I mean, that's...
I never thought of that before.
Really?
Yeah.
Comic books taught me that as a kid.
Really?
Yeah, Alan Moore wrote that in an episode of an issue of Swamp Thing and made me very aware about women's... what they had to endure.
Really?
As much as a comic book could help a 12-year-old understand.
Yeah, I wouldn't say
that
you
women
have,
get
you maybe had a deep understanding of that.
Walked around with that comic book in my back pocket for years, impressing women
with your comic book. Most likely
on
not.
On buses, grocery stores, wherever, I could just show them the comic book. Hey, I understand women's suffering and menstruation.
Oh my God, I hope that you did not do that.
I did not.
Okay. We're being extra goofy tonight. We must be. We must be
we're
extra
sun drunk.
We probably
are.
We got
sunlight today.
Okay. The moon.
Yeah, sorry.
Romance. Far away celestials, right? Here's the moon again, mm-hmm. and the stars. So obviously there's night, and night is happening here. But instead of being on a hot date, any one of them, right? Or being home, snuggled up, they're not there, right? They're together. There's also a way in which this increases the characterization of these men as very mundane, right? The moon is high up. The stars are bitter. The moon is moving their chairs, right?
And it's also two fingers, which is a drink measurement above the tree line.
Oh, yeah, that's in the very next line. And they're kind of complacent with their lot in life at this particular moment, probably because they're happy and satisfied. It's no wonder that in the next line, it suggests a kind of dreamy, almost romantic mood, starting with the moon. Again, the moon was clearing the trees by two fingers. But you're right. Two fingers is also a drink measurement, which I never thought of before. And then I took bets we'd be happy, which I love. I'll bet we'll be happy someday, you know, and then no one ever knows. The scholar sighed, empty trumpet in hand. I smiled. John smiled. So the moon is clearing the trees to allow them a better look at the stars, but we've already heard before the stars are bitter, right? They think that they're thinking about their future, their ambition, possibly. And here, more than any other place, we see clearly what their ambition really is. I took bets we'd be happy. Their ambition is for happiness, right? For love and a sense of belonging. They're clumsily making a home for themselves. Between the three of them, right? They recognize that they're not much different from the dogs around them, that they're somehow kind of like strays. But the promise of a good home is their ultimate ambition. And this particular moment, this communion between friends is a moment of real happiness, right? The scholar, no one ever knows, could be saying yes or no. Like, sure, it could happen to us. That might be in the stars for us. But there's also like a little joke, you know, I took bets we'd be happy, as if they weren't happy right then.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they definitely have a sense of optimism, and the friends have a moment in which they're all smiling at one another. And then this smile is amplified by the next line, by the grinning cats. Right.
They're the ones who stole the chair.
The I think possibly yeah. so. Yeah. So cats with full lives grinned from the back fence, sniffed. Drop to the ground to nudge us for the love of chicken, but love all the same.
And the cats, full lives, so they haven't had anything bad happen because they got all nine of them.
But also, like, the full lives as in they have something to do on a, what, Saturday. They maybe have a home to go to, right? That they're definitely aligned with the cats toward the end, whose only ambition, perhaps, is to eat chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us right back up to the start again. So they have something in common with the cats, but in the hierarchy of things, these cats actually rank higher in what he's got here. So anthropomorphism is going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's for those of you at home who may not know, that's the literary technique of describing an animal or object in a way that makes it behave and appear like it is a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That is giving human characteristics to things that are not human, inanimate objects, animals, etc. And here you see the cats grinning and his statement that they have full lives. Perhaps in comparison to the men in the poem whose lives are empty enough to spend a night out talking about the possibility of happiness while getting drunk, right? But I think throughout the poem, there's also been the use of zoomorphism, which is a word that is derived from the Greek meaning animal and shape or form. It's used to describe art that imagines humans as non-human animals.
Okay.
Or art that portrays one species of animal like another species of animal.
Oh.
So here at the end, with them laying on their bellies and elbows in the grass, with cats sniffing them and nudging up against them, I assume probably licking them, they maybe aren't even as high up in the animal kingdom as the cats. Like, they smell like dinner, right? And the love of chicken, but the love all the same. He almost seems to be like shrugging at the end here. Like, hey, I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, if that's the interest the cat has in me, sure. I'm not proud. I'll take it. Which is, I'm guessing, is how you felt about me when we met.
What are you talking about?
My advances.
You weren't advancing. I was advancing upon you, and you were clueless.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I decided, sure, whatever. You're right.
You're you're right. Why did I fight that point? Now I feel so used. So there's something about this, and I think probably it's the Romans with good jobs line. And there's something about it that, you know, with the title of ambition, I begin to sort of think about both ambition and friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began looking for it, I went straight to the Roman philosopher.
Okay. Wait. Horace.
Horace is a poet.
But he was Roman, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, at least I'm half right.
Maybe he was a philosopher too. I don't know. I only know his poetry. But I have this quote from Seneca on ambition.
Hmm.
And I thought that we'd think about that in relation to another quote from Cicero on friendship.
I do know Cicero.
Do you?
I mean, not personally, obviously, but yeah.
Could we call him up right now? So Seneca on ambition and achievement. It is inevitable that life will not just be very short, but very miserable for those who acquire by great toil what they must keep by greater toil.
Mm.
They achieve what they want laboriously. They possess what they have achieved anxiously. And meanwhile, they take no account of time that will never more return. New preoccupations take the place of the old. Hope excites more hope, and ambition more ambition. They do not look for an end to their misery, but simply change the reason for it.
Hmm.
He does go on to say that this relationship to ambition and achievement is even more toxic for one's sense of self and happiness if one is working for someone else, right? That is working toward someone else's goals. I don't think he's against hard work here, right? He's just for hard, good work.
Yeah.
The problem is so many people's ambitions are to achieve certain markers or to obtain certain things. Mm. But if ambition is to find good work with good people, then that might be fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, good work is work that you do that feels satisfying in the end, labor that you welcome in some way. I don't know.
All those shoes I sold. That was good labor. I was so content there. Made me think,
You clearly were not. If for any other reason than you talked about deboned kittens and somebody. And I don't mean to say that that's dark. I mean, you are clearly a wildly creative person who should not be a shoe salesman only, right?
Yeah.
Like that shouldn't be. Like, clearly you were wanting to flex your creative muscles there, and you thought you were just being sort of...
Well, I thought it was a great sell. Like, they're going to remember that line every time they look at the shoe or whatever. I thought I was making a good attachment to the shoes. Like, because I was very proud. It just rolled right out. I'm like, ooh, that's a great
editor
way to
there. Consider your audience.
It was back in my drinking days. I didn't have an editor back then. I was not drunk, though, while at work.
Yeah, we should probably
drunk
clarify.
Shoe salesman. a bitter drunk shoe salesman who's overeducated. A joy for everybody.
That's horrible. Okay, somebody's got to write a short story about that. Seriously. I can't even remember where I was going with this.
Well, we were talking about work that is good and fulfilling.
Right.
And then I think you were going to go to Cicero next.
Yes, absolutely. So Cicero has one of my most favorite quotes on friendship.
Oh, okay.
It's really brief. Friendship improves happiness and abates misery by the doubling of our joy and the dividing of our grief.
Hmm.
And I love this so much because it's so accurate, right? Like, I can't remember how many times I would be traveling alone and see something gorgeous and or interesting or compelling in some way. And I would turn to my right or my left in order to talk to somebody.
It was actually just the volleyball Wilson from Castaway.
Exactly right. Like traveling alone sucks, and it sucks for me.
I loved it.
Did you?
I really liked being, when I traveled around the U.S. by myself, I liked it.
Oh, see, I'm talking about traveling abroad. And I don't.
Also, I was wallowing in my depression, and I felt that it was that much better.
This romanticized loneliness.
Oh, I'm so pain. Yeah, never mind. I was, wallowing in my own depression when I was traveling like that.
No, anytime that I saw something amazing, what I wanted was somebody there to share it with, right? Mm-hmm. Like amplifying your joy. in some way. So you can both be like, oh my God, did you say that? You know, like that's like my most favorite thing. But then also like the dividing of our grief.
Yeah. Right?
To have a friend to grieve with.
It lightens the load.
It totally does. Like whether or not you both experience a thing or like you're just down in the dumps because something bad happened to you, you call up your friend, right? They come over, they bring some chicken, they bring some booze.
And you let it out.
Yeah.
The pressure releases.
Right. And you feel better. I mean, if for no other reason that you feel like you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think that it's such a simple phrase, but I think that it absolutely captures the way that I think of friendship anyways. For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Ambition by author Gary Soto. If you'd like to read the poem, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. There's another quote here by Cicero. Friendship, on the other hand, serves a great host of different purposes all at the same time. In whatever direction you turn, it still remains yours. No barrier can shut it out. It can never be untimely, can never be in the way. We need friendship all the time, just as much as we need the proverbial prime necessities of life, fire and water.
In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, friendships or companionship was up there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can feel that happening in this poem, right? The dividing of grief and the amplifying of joy happening, and also the necessity of it. They're eating, they're drinking, they're building fire, and there is something kind of prehistoric about their bond here, mm-hmm. right? They're getting drunk, they're looking at the moon, they're dreaming about the future in some ways, and they're eating and they're hanging out with animals.
Yeah, and they're laying more to the ground.
Yeah, their bellies are to the ground at the end of this, right? They're on the lawn chairs to begin with, and then at some point they're standing, but then at the end they're just like laying on the earth.
Yeah. Just laying on their backs. Cats are now looking down at them.
And it's clear that they need each other, that this goes beyond, oh, I didn't have anything better to do, and so I went over here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're building, like I said before, a home and a domestic space for themselves. And for each other. Yay, friends.
Well, let's have you do that again for us.
My next read is going to be more ambitious.
If you want to read along with Danielle's ambitious reading of this poem, just go to our website, litfromthebasement.com, click on the show notes tab along the top, then scroll to the show title with the poem's name. The most recent show is always on top.
Ambition by Gary Soto. For years, our ambition was to eat chicken, to sit in the backyard in an aftershock of heat when the sun was out of the way. This happened. Drunk under a tree, we became sophisticates of the lawn chair and beer bottles, trumpets we raised all night under those bitter stars that turned us to our lies of women, lost and found, door to door. I was lonely once, I told them, and they booed and flicked beer tops at me, told me to get into the kitchen for the hard stuff. When I returned, Chris, the failed scholar of 3 degrees, talked Italy. Flames broke from the hibachi. The chicken grew noisy as a Latin mob. Quiet, John yelled, and poked them with a fork onto the platter. We went inside to argue over salad, a gaudy hat we stuffed into our mouths, and let food climb our elbows. Dogs snapped at bones, whined, jumped when we threw them buttered rolls, corn, rings of potato. We ate like Romans with good jobs, and returned to the backyard to find that the moon had moved our chairs. Lost them, in fact. We dropped on the grass, on elbows, The moon was clearing the trees by two fingers. I took bets we'd be happy. No one ever knows, the scholar sighed, empty trumpet in hand. I smiled. John smiled. Cats with full lives grinned from the back fence, sniffed, dropped to the ground to nudge us for the love of chicken, but love all the same.
So sometime this summer, we'll go out, drink, and lay in the grass.
I love that plan. You are one of my best friends.
One. Okay. You're not my best. You're not my only best friend either. I've got all kinds of people. I've got one son, two sons that I talk to all day long.
I have a little bit more on friendship.
Let's hear
if you'd
it.
Like to hear. So
since you got so many friends, apparently it's insights that all of us should have. Thrall me.
I don't know that you're going to be thralled by this. So, have you heard of Aristotle's classification of friends? Aristotle loves to classify things.
His classification of what?
Friendship.
No, I have not.
Into three different types. So
the platonic.
No, friendships of utility are those where people are on like are friendly terms, but they're mainly due to the benefits that they get from one another. Friendships of pleasure are those that we find because they bring enjoyment to our lives. So people are kind of hanging out because they have the same interests, right?
Also, you can absolutely conflate one and two.
Yeah.
Utilitarian pleasures.
Well, I
it's your buddy.
No, I don't think that Aristotle had that in mind with these particular categories. He certainly didn't because he really likes discrete categories, right? Also, like I thought what you were saying when you actually first said that is this really weird idea that somehow pleasure is not a utility. That pleasure doesn't have its own use.
Oh.
And I'm not saying that necessarily Aristotle say this. I'm talking about this thinking or trend in at least contemporary culture.
Well, because I'm going to guess capitalism.
Yeah.
How do you get a dollar out of that?
Well, I mean, it's just bizarre. I had, you know, like people who are like, well, what's the point of literature or what's the point of poetry? And I'm like, pleasure. Like, who wants a life without beauty or pleasure? I don't want to live that life.
No, you're a big fan of pleasure.
I really am. But the third classification.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There's three.
Are friendships of the good, which he sees as being the most important.
Mm-hmm.
So these are friendships that are based on respect, appreciation for each other's essential qualities, and a strong will to aid and assist the other person because they recognize their greatness, their individuality,
their value.
Exactly. So the first two types of friendships, he says, are easily broken, utility or pleasure, right? These friendships are driven by
utilitarian and pleasurable needs.
Indeed. but that friendships of the good are really rare and hard to find. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with, I mean, what he's describing there is kind of what I like to call falling into friend love, right? Like you meet somebody and you just like think they're rad. You know, you start talking to them and you just keep talking to them and you have a lot of the same interests usually. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't, you have a way to like sort of talk through and or be interested in each other's interests. Like, oh, I've never heard of that. That sounds rad.
And then you find out your first cousins.
Again, not romantic terms here.
And you still pursue the friendship.
But I guess I've been thinking about friendship partly because I threw a CD into my car the other day, which was a mix from my college era.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about, you know, my college era friends and really missing them. And also just thinking about how our contemporary society with social media adds a whole other strange element to quote unquote friendship.
Yeah.
Mostly because of the actual language used in that, right? Like starting with Facebook, with friending somebody or unfriending somebody. And what that means.
Well, starting with Friendster. And then Facebook took over.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Friendster.
And MySpace.
I didn't forget about MySpace. I actually was on MySpace.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. And then was like, oh, nobody else seems to be here. I'll move over to Friendster.
A digital tumbleweed just blew by. Yeah. Here's a band that's hounding me. Yeah. Why is...
That's exactly right. I thought there was a really interesting quote from Seneca that one could apply to social media, friend and or friendships, or at least social media displays. There is a class of men who communicate to anyone whom they meet matters which should be revealed to friends alone and unload upon the chance listener whatever irks them. Others, again, fear to confide in their closest intimates. And if it were possible, they would not trust even themselves, bearing their secrets deep in their hearts. But we should do neither. It is equally faulty to trust everyone and to trust no one. Yet the former fault is, I should say, the more ingenuous, the latter, the more safe.
And Chuck Palahniuk wrote in Fight Club, "Strangers with this kind of honesty give me a big rubbery one."
Gross.
Yours was lofty. Yes, mine was a little earthy and crude.
But it is Chuck Palahniuk.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So I sort of expect that from him.
Yeah. He has a, or the character had a love of people sharing inappropriate information.
I mean, sometimes friendships are actually forged that way.
Yeah. It's kind of like a way of firing a flare into the sky. I'm going to walk in this room, overshare, or say something wrong, and we'll just see who stays in the room.
Yeah, that may have been how our relationship actually started.
Okay, and on those wonderful notes, our theme music is by Status Q.
We have links on our homepage for you to subscribe to our show on iTunes and Spotify. You can also subscribe through the Google Play Store.
Our show notes have their own tab on our website. There you can find a copy of the work we discussed, a link to purchase the work, author information, and anything else we thought might be relevant.
If you have a comment, suggestion, correction, or an alternate reading of the poem, send us a message using our contact page.
And if you're curious about Danielle's work, you can hear shows on each of her three books. Just click on the Vanity Press tab on our website.
All right, friends.
Oh, our only friends.
We love you, friends.
The people in Bangladesh, the people in Kobe, Japan. You guys, we're glad you're here. We just don't know how you came to us. Write us a message and let us know.
We would love to know.
And depending on when you're listening to this, good night.
Or good morning.
Yeah, or good afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I was lonely once, I told them, and they booed. And I know, I love that line. It cracks me up.
I know, but you started laughing while you were reading it.
I know. Okay. I'm going to just start from the top.
Okay.